Welcome to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen, and I'm here, as always, with fellow beat reporter Bob McGinn. It's late on a Wednesday evening west of Lambeau Field. It's frigid out there, Bob. My car thermometer said 4 degrees on the way over here, and that's not counting the wind.
but it's dry, Mike. Clear and dry.
That's true.
But that's not going to stay like that.
No, it is not.
More on the weather later, coming
yes.
up.
But
we'll
now,
tease to the weather, okay?
For now, we jump into this podcast brought to you by Cannon and Dunphy. And you recognize my music today, Bob. You knew it. Took you a couple seconds.
I knew the artist, but and I've heard the song, certainly. But I can't say I'm a know that song a lot.
Pat knew the song. She knew the song right away. Used to dance to the song with her daughter when she was a kid.
Yeah.
And she knew it right away. She might be more hip than you, Bob.
Oh, I'm sure she is. There's no question.
But, okay, Michael Jackson, is that an artist that you listened to at all over the years or no?
I mean, I never bought any of his stuff.
Okay.
I certainly listened to him and appreciated him, but
sure.
He's not a guy that I'm, you know.
How about the Jackson 5?
Oh, yeah. Like them, too.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
All right.
I like them. Now, how about you?
Yeah, I actually got into the Jackson 5 before I got into Michael Jackson himself, which is kind of backwards, I think, for most people my age. But because I've talked about this a lot, I like the 60s, the 70s, you know, all that stuff, the older things, the Jackson 5 popped up more often than regular Michael Jackson did. And then when I was in high school and I was in that little rock band with my friends, that's when Michael Jackson became more prevalent as a solo artist, and I started listening to, you know, Thriller and all this stuff, and that's when I really got into it. But this is my favorite Michael Jackson song, so that's PYT, Pretty Young Thing.
Kay.
I think it peaked at number 11 or something like that. It wasn't one of his number ones. But
what year, you think?
Oh, boy. I looked it up today, and I can't remember. Let's see. I'll look it up real fast. What do we got?
The year?
82.
Okay.
1982.
Okay.
So 8 years before I was born, Bob.
Yeah, okay.
You were already covering the Packers?
On a part-time basis.
Okay, 84 was your first one, right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, so that's the music we got. Anything else we need to discuss here off the top? Oh, well, we should tell them that I'm not on painkilling medication.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that I was going to have my surgery Monday, and that was the plan. I went into the hospital. I was hooked up to the IV, to the heart monitor, all that stuff. And there was a minor little issue with something on my knee that may or may not have introduced some bacteria, so we postponed it. Dr. McKenzie erred on the side of caution. And so it's now going to be Tuesday, so 2 days after the Bears game, and then I'll be laid up. And my occupancy at the McGinn household stays valid, so
right.
I will be on the couch for the majority of the week. And then we got the Vikes after that. I don't think I'm going to be there for the Vikes. I might be out of commission.
The Vikes and Christmas, Mike.
The Vikes and Christmas.
Yep. And the Vike game stays at noon, correct?
Yes, which is important.
That's really good of the NFL, isn't it?
It's very good of them.
They always think of the common guy.
Always. Especially when it comes to concussion money. So, anything else on the agenda?
Nothing.
Okay, so let's talk about the game that was. This was a beatdown by the Green Bay Packers against the Seattle Seahawks. What was the final score? 38-10?
Correct.
38-10 when the Packers were 3-point underdogs.
Yeah.
Just not anything I expected. I don't think it was something that a lot of people expected. I guess the first thing that jumps out to me, and it's probably the most obvious, is just the 5 interceptions. I mean, Russell Wilson came into this game having thrown 5 all season. He leaves matching his season total. This is a Packers team that was in the middle of the pack at best when it came to interceptions over the course of the season relative to the rest of the league. What can you say about that secondary, Bob?
Love those takeaways, Mike. 2 were great plays, Mr. Randall and Mr. Burnett. 3 tips. I don't care. There were people around that ball hustling to get them. I used to call that stuff luck. Maybe you still want to call it luck, but I'm not going to. I'm going to call that skill and hustle and determination, and all that luck evens out anyway. So they got five off a really good quarterback who had a really bad day against a team that never, ever, ever gets blown out, Mike. Do you believe that? Their worst loss since mid-2010. They haven't lost a game by more than 10 points in four and a half years.
So one of the things that jumped out to me about those interceptions is, you know, and I'm like you, I don't care about the deflections. The deflection is part of the game. You know, if you catch an interception because a guy dropped the pass, that's not a knock on you. That's you going out and making a play to get the interception. But the one thing I noticed was that there were two of them, it might have even been three. No, it was two. Two of the five that hit Seahawks players in the face mask and then bounced away. Went through the hands, hit the face mask, bounced away. When you were in the Seahawks locker room, did anyone mention having trouble with the lights or anything like that? I was wondering if... And both guys wore dark visors on their helmets.
Pope. Oh, Pope, that's right. Okay.
And so I wondered if, for whatever reason, maybe they had trouble seeing the ball or something, because... You know, it might happen once in a while where a ball goes off somebody's face mask, but two to be interceptions where they could see it the whole way and it wasn't over the shoulder. I just wondered if there was something going on there.
I never heard that. It would have been good to ask, though, Mike. Okay. Yeah, it's a good point.
So, you know, when you look at this secondary, I think this was huge for a confidence booster. And I don't necessarily just mean getting the turnovers, because that would boost the confidence of any secondary. But I think for the players involved, this was very important. You know, Demaryius Randall was having an interesting season. Bothered by injury for so long, he comes back and he looks kind of tentative. He's not really his normal self. He gets two interceptions and all of a sudden his swagger and all that is back. And then Quentin Rollins, I think, is a player that was really in his own head for a lot of this season. And so even though he didn't have a whole lot to do on that interception, it was a tipped pass off the shoulder of Ladarius Gunter, I think it was big for him to make a play and contribute in a real positive way, because he hadn't really done that a lot this season. In your experience, you know, covering these teams, when young players do make a play or two plays in a game, do you find that that can carry over into subsequent weeks?
The game's about confidence, you know, and yes, I do see that. I also want to take it a step further with that pick by Morgan Burnett. I mean, this is a guy who's done a lot for this franchise, and he hasn't made a lot of big plays, and he knows it, and everybody knows it, and the path to the Pro Bowl, you have to have big plays. I'm not going to say it's the greatest play in his career, but it's got to be certainly in his top 3 to 5. What a play. Jimmy Graham picks him up man-to-man, kind of the way Leroy Butler used to do against slot receivers like Ben Coates of the Patriots and others back in the 20 years ago. But, you know, Butler played cornerback at Florida State. Burnett's been a safety his whole life, and I think. And he covered him. The ball, the break point was 12 yards downfield. He was on him like stink on you-know-what. And he undercut that route, caught the ball in his hands. It was a remarkable, marvelous play.
I think it was on Monday, Coach Mike McCarthy said that that he thinks this is Morgan Burnett's finest season so far of his career. What do you think?
I'd have to go back and look at my, you know, look at my grades each year. I hate just saying that. I don't know. I'd go back and compare what I think with the grades when I wrote them within a week after all his other seasons. I'm not sure.
Now, I can only compare to last year, because last year was my first season on the beat, but without even necessarily going back and looking at, you know, stats or contributions, just the eye test, I think he's having a much larger influence on games this year than he was last year. And part of the reason is because of that sort of new hybrid position they're allowing him to play. And that's what enabled him to pick up Jimmy Graham so much. It's this inside linebacker that can be thought of sort of two ways. You can think of it as him actually playing a nickel linebacker, or you can think of it as a dime formation with an extra safety on the field, and that safety happens to line up essentially even with the other inside backer. Now, Morgan Burnett thinks of it as the latter. He thinks of it as the dime defense. He doesn't necessarily view himself as an inside linebacker. But Dom Capers gave that position a special name. He calls it the WHIP, W-H-I-P. And to me, that was sort of his indication of, or his way of saying, rather, that it pretty much is an inside linebacker. We just got to give it a different name.
Yep.
Why do you think he's able, or what in his skill set allows him to play closer to the box, whereas certain safeties can't really do that?
He's just a tough guy, Mike. He's not afraid going among those 315-pound guards. You know, he's not afraid. Now, the Seahawks gashed him. I mean, they put a hurting on him. There's no question. You're nodding. You saw it. 137 yards for Seattle. Thomas Rawls is one heck of a back. Daryl Bevel saw that, and he said, well, we're going to make you pay, and they did make him pay. And it might have been a strategy to win the game had Wilson not been awful and had the ball not kind of bounced around a few times. But be that as it may, Barnett still made a bunch of tackles. He floats around. He's not afraid, and he just kind of gets in the muck and mucks it up. And then you got to give him credit.
Yeah, before your game story went online Sunday afternoon, I wrote the little quick thing that we put up at the buzzer that just sort of gives a summary of the game. And one of the categories is what went right, and another one is what went wrong. And for my what went wrong section, I said, well, pretty much nothing. The only thing McCarthy could point to is the run defense. And I said, but on a day where Russell Wilson was turning the ball over left and right and Aaron Rodgers was as efficient as he was, it didn't even matter how many yards they gave up. You know, 100 and what, 137? You know, for a clip of over 5 yards a carry, I think it was.
I think so.
And it couldn't have been more irrelevant in terms of the outcome of the game. It didn't matter. It didn't matter at all. But Burnett, I think the reason why they like doing that is because he can cover tight ends. And I've written about this a couple times. The Packers have struggled when it comes to covering tight ends this season. And, you know, Micah Hyde has had his issues, you know, whether it's a lack of quickness or a lack of size. Blake Martinez and Jake Ryan have both struggled at times. And there's instances where Joe Thomas gets fooled in coverage as well. So I think that this whip position is a way for them to get somebody that they feel is a better overall athlete and better match onto these tight ends. And, you know, Jimmy Graham, one catch for 16 yards, and a lot of that was due in part to what Morgan Burnett was able to do.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I agree all the way.
When you look at this secondary in terms of finally getting these guys healthy, and they have this trio now of Gunter, Randall, and Rollins. Earlier in the year, when they had some spare parts in there, Dimitri Goodson, when Rollins was playing, you know, on the outside, which is not necessarily his best spot, that was a group that I don't necessarily think could contend at this level on a consistent basis. But with these three guys they have now, their first and second round pick a year ago, and then Gunter, a player that they seem to really like, is that a trio that you think can do some stuff here and down the stretch the rest of this season?
Not really.
I mean, why not?
Just talent and experience. You got three second-year guys. I mean, when I think back to the teams that won Super Bowls here, you know, what they had at cornerback in 96 and 2010, no, it just doesn't stack up to me. It doesn't really seem like a championship secondary, or corners, as you suggested, yeah.
Okay. So I guess moving forward, we'll have to see how those guys sort of adapt down the stretch here, because the one thing that will benefit them, regardless of talent, is if they can all stay healthy. Joe Witt talks about it all the time, continuity among, you know, your corners, because yes, you might have individual matchups, but the ability to play off one another is certainly very important at that position. So if they can stay healthy, that will be to their benefit there. One area that we need to discuss, too, is on the other side of the ball, how well the offensive line played for the Packers. You wrote about it. You've got the paper here in front. Your third star of the game was Brian Bulaga. I guess, really, let's start with the bookends. What did you think of what he and Bakhtiari did?
Frank Clark, a really, really good rusher. He didn't get a pressure. Cliff Averill had two of their three, and Michael Bennett had zero, and some people think Bennett is maybe the best inside-outside combination going in the league. Bulaga played well. He had a terrible game at Seattle 4 years ago, and I think he's been motivated ever since not to allow that to happen. He set well. His hands were really almost perfect. He played really good football. Bakhtiari, I call him a athletic technician the other day, and I really think he is. He's in his fourth year now, and he's got the big money, and he's earned every penny of it after he got signed to that deal. He had Bennett. He had Clark. Cassius Marsh is a hard-working number four rusher. He's not bad either, and he really didn't have many problems either. So it was an outstanding game in pass pro for the Packers. Now, in the run game, 5 of the 9 bad runs were charged to the line. I think there was a lot of problems there. T.J. Lang, first game back, he meant an awful lot as an enforcer. in a game that required that. And but he wasn't sharp. He gave it his all, but I don't think that injury is still back to where it was. Taylor was fine, and Lindsley was fine. So all in all, I gave them 4.5 footballs, and they deserved it against a heck of a group.
What was the blitz percentage by the Seahawks? Do you have it in front of you here?
Yes. 14.8% by Chris Richard.
Okay, so over the course of a game, and you've seen many more football games than I have, when a team is struggling to get pressure the way that the Seahawks were, what would be the thinking behind continuing with a low blitz rate? In other words, why wouldn't you try sending more guys just to see what happens?
Just because they've won so many games doing it this way. They want to be simplistic. They didn't have Earl Thomas in the back to, you know, handle things, get people down. I mean, this other guy was just invisible, right, Mike? Stephen Terrell. And when he finally did blitz with 2 minutes to go in the first half, we saw what happened. Roger just saw that thing coming, the fifth man. It was K.J. Wright leaping in his face, and he threw the fade to Adams. Ugh, beautiful. Clinical.
Yeah, I was just curious because we've seen from time to time this season and last year as well and in the years since he's been here, you know, Dom Capers will bring different kinds of blitzes. You know, he'll bring his inside backers, sure. He'll bring, he'll bring his outside backers and then drop a lineman every once in a while too in a zone blitz. But one of the things he does is bring corners. You know, he'll bring guys off the edge, whether it's Rollins or Micah Hyde, or we've saw him, he's blitzed Clinton Dixon Burnett at times. And so when the Seahawks did choose to blitz, I felt like it was almost exclusively linebackers. You know, you didn't see Richard Sherman going after the quarterback. You didn't see Deshaun Shedd really going after the quarterback. And so, you know, me, obviously I'm not a football coach. I just wondered why you wouldn't try and change it up. But I do understand the we do what we do argument, and that's kind of what it is.
They just don't disguise anything, Mike. You see the Packers disguising with Clinton Dix and Burnett back and forth,
constantly
up and down, late in the time clock. Seattle, they're just going to line up and man you up, man. Not man, but just play you straight. Let their talent win out, man against man.
It comes with a touch of arrogance, for sure.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it, but... And you mentioned it. The results obviously back up that arrogance and reinforce it. So.
Yeah. So I don't know. We'll have to see about this Earl Thomas thing, you know. I mean, he meant a lot to him. If you're a good team, you play over Earl Thomas, however. And so they got a game here Thursday night. He's probably good. They don't have to wait that long. Who are they playing Thursday night?
I have no idea.
The Rams, I believe.
What do you make of all the eggs that Seattle has laid on the road this year? 10 points in Green Bay, 6 points in Arizona, 3 points against the Rams, I think it was, or something like that. I mean, I was looking back through it was Tampa Bay where they laid another one. I mean, they can't score points on the road.
You know, I hate to question their pass rush, but their pass rush is helped by the noise at, what's it, CenturyLink Field or whatever. I think, you know, Clark, Averill, and Bennett are good enough where they shouldn't have to rely on noise, but they've got one sack in 3 games. They got to pick it up. And I would think, based on their track record, I don't think Bennett's the same since this knee scope. You know, he's played 2 full games now. I didn't think he was very good in the game before Green Bay. He wasn't very good. Well, I can't say he wasn't very good. He was blocked hard the other day. So, well, I went over to the Seattle locker room, Mike, afterwards for a few minutes. And Bennett just went on and on about holding. He was talking to a bunch of writers, and he kept saying how he didn't name names, but how the Packer blockers were engulfing him and others. And he said the tops of their jerseys and into the back of their jerseys were ripped. Now, come on. Now, one of their people told me that he kind of puts people on sometimes with all the stuff he says. And I think maybe that applies to this one. But so then I got him alone. I pressed him a little bit on about the defeat. And then at that point, he was gracious and he didn't make any excuses. But he certainly had before that. Cliff Averill, he wasn't in any kind of mood. I mean, he had a couple scuffles with Lang and whatever. And he was in no mood to be handing out any bouquets. I mean, he'd probably like to play him tomorrow, you know. And... so he grudgingly, no, but he did say, he talked about the wet field, And it was wet, there's no question, but it was in really good shape. The grounds crew this week did an excellent job. And but he said that, you know, I'm a professional athlete, and that didn't beat us, something to that effect. So it was kind of interesting hearing these guys.
So, you know, I mentioned their propensity to come out flat or play flat on the road, and that sort of plays into what you wrote your Sunday column about, which is when you play this team and when you play Pete Carroll with the way he structured his program, you have to fight fire with fire, essentially. You have to match what they're going to do in terms of intensity. Now, I don't think any of us expected Seattle to come out and just basically lay down, but why did you think that against this opponent it was more important than in other games, perhaps, to come up with this heightened sense of energy and focus?
They're just in-your-face people, you know, Mike? That whole defense from Richard Sherman, I mean, they're just in-your-face. Bobby Wagner, Bennett, others who have left there. They're going to try to physically intimidate you until they no longer can do so. It's just, and it's the way they played all those games, and the Packers, I didn't think, responded to it. They, in the first two games, the third game in this five-game series, they did. In that title game they lost for three quarters, their defense dominated that game, and they really stood up for themselves. And then they won the game last year. They learned, and there was a lot of bumping and grinding and fighting and in their face and returning the favor. The other day, I thought Mike Daniels was just totally instrumental in this victory. He got off the ball so hard, Mike. You certainly saw this. He didn't lose control of his emotions like he did in that title game when he hit J.R. Sweezy. He didn't hit him. He went down there and ran down the sideline and taunted him after an interception early. So he was just, he pursued like a man on fire. And I just, the way he was running out of the piles and packs and things like that, it was really something. I made him player of the game. It was a tough call against Aaron Rodgers. I just thought this emotionalism he showed and the physicality deserved the number one slot. You know, he wasn't mentioned, I'm sure, on radio or TV or all that stuff, but to me, the underpinning of that defeat was Mike Daniels. And the Packers responded in kind. They gave up yards on the ground, but their pass rush was solid. And they hit people. There's evidence of all kinds of hits and pursuit. I thought they flew to the ball really well, and that's what you have to do.
And I think just generally they played with some aggressiveness, you know, across the board. You highlighted Daniels, but, I mean, I can think of some other plays, and you pointed some of them out in your rating. That play with Randall Cobb along the sideline where he has a chance to go out of bounds or go shoulder to shoulder or chest to shoulder with, was it Wagner or Wright?
Wagner.
With Bobby Wagner. And instead of going out of bounds, despite giving up probably 60 or 70 pounds, he smashes into him. He doesn't pick up any yardage from it because obviously he's given up 60 or 70 pounds, but that sends a little bit of a message, I think. You look at some of the other plays that we saw. One that jumps out to me, if we talked about it already, is that interception by Burnett. He bodies off a player that is physical, that is a basketball player, that is used to boxing people out, and he swoops in front to make an interception. You look at Richard Rodgers. I mean, he took an unbelievable shot, immediately popped back up, and went after it a little bit. He took a couple. I mean, Richard Rodgers is a quiet guy, so he's not going to go Mike Daniels crazy on anybody. But he got drilled, got up, and took a couple steps after the Seahawks and had to be separated lightly. And so those are the types of things from some players that aren't Mike Daniels, that aren't TJ Lang, that if I'm Mike McCarthy, I'm really pleased to see some of that fire and passion spreading to different parts of the roster.
And then when you do fight fire with fire, even the Seahawks tend to melt down. Look at Jeremy Lane at the end of the half on the kneel down, right, Mike? Takes that stupid, gratuitous shot at Randall Cobb. Just a ridiculous, non-professional act. To Cobb's credit, again, Bakhtiari then confronted Lane. Didn't do any swinging or anything. And then Cobb just kind of walked off. And then there was one more. Cliff Averill at the end of the game. You know, he got a penalty.
He shoved Richard Rodgers in the back.
Yeah, right. They kind of lost it. They melted down, and they got their butts kicked. And, sometimes that's a team you do not expect that. And Green Bay, a statement victory for Mike McCarthy and that team.
And there was a cheap shot by Richard Sherman, too. Did you see that one?
Against Adams?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. You're right, it was.
A shoulder into the back when they were completely away from the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
that
you're
was.
Right. They lost their cool. Anything else you want to talk about from the Seattle game?
No, I think we got it, Mike.
Okay, we're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some weather, Bob. We got some weather to talk about this weekend. I'm looking forward to it.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
So you've dug up the archives here. We have some old newspapers, and you can tell that they're old because they're a totally different color than the ones sitting on the counter here from a more recent date. It's got that nice little, I don't know, how would you describe it? Looks like
newsprint.
Burlap. It looks like a scroll. Something just very antiquated. But here we are. And the purpose is you went back and you dug up some weather games because, well, it looks like we might have one for the ages potentially on Sunday. But before we do that, let's talk about what they've already played through in this Bear-Packer rivalry.
So I think the first time I ever covered a game there was in 82, I believe, maybe 80, something like that. So I've seen three, to my best memory, three terrible weather games at Soldier Field. 1983 in the season finale, 1994 on Halloween night, and 2007 in mid-December. The Packers dominated that monsoon windswept game in 94. They kill the Bears, I can't remember, 31-3 or something like that. Who knows? I don't know. 34-6. An amazing victory. Okay, but what we're facing here Sunday, Mike, is horrible wind chill, a weekend of snow Friday and Saturday, no snow Sunday, high Sunday probably 2-1, wind chills, who knows, minus 20, something like that.
I don't know. I saw -3 for the high.
Wow. Okay, so there's two frigid games that apply to this, okay? So let's review them. 1983, the season finale. This is Bart Starr's ninth year. The Packers go in there. They need help to make the playoffs. They're 8-7. And that help comes. They need the Rams, the L.A. Rams, to beat New Orleans. And that victory was flashed on TV. I remember this, Mike, in the press box, the old press box at Old Soldier. With about 2 minutes left in that game, it came on final, L.A. won. So if Green Bay wins this game and finishes 9-7, they're in the playoffs, a wild card berth. It would be their first playoff berth in a full season since 1972, 11 years. Okay. The temperature's 3 degrees, winds about 30 miles an hour. Only 35,000 showed up. The Bears were 6-9, I believe, at that point, okay? The Packers were favored in this game. Okay, with about 4 minutes left, Green Bay has a 21-20 lead. And the Bears get the ball on their own 36. And Walter Payton is on the sidelines. He suffered a rib injury in the fourth quarter. He's out. So you got Matt Sui carrying the ball and Jim McMahon. This is before they got really good, Mike. The Bears were not that good in 83. And on they drove down this field. And the defense, it was a great offense for Green Bay that year and a terrible defense, the league's worst. And again, the defense folded up. Although it's hard to, the offense cannot be blameless. They turned it over 7 times, Mike. Lynn Dickey had four picks, I think, and they three fumbles. Do you believe that? Turnovers were far more prevalent 35 years ago, Mike.
I don't know. Seattle had 6 last week.
Yeah. That's like once a generation nowadays. Okay. So this game ends. Bob Thomas hit a 22-yard field goal as, I don't know, like 15 seconds left to give the Bears a 23-21 victory. But this game is most remembered. It's the last game Bart Starr ever coached, okay?
Nice hair. I hadn't seen your column headshot from back then. You got a little afro going on there, Bob.
So, Mike, after the two plays prior to the winning field goal by Mr. Thomas, Bart Starr did not call timeout. I mean, in this day and age, coaches, you know, then they might have 8 or 9 coaches. Now they got 20 and analytics people on your in your headset. I mean, more mistakes were made in game management, but still, okay? But still. So had he called those timeouts after the Thomas field goal, they would have had about 50 seconds left and one timeout to give Jan Stenerud a chance for a winning field goal. Lynn Dickey to Lofton, that can happen. And when Bart was asked about this, his strategy after the game, he stonewalled it. He said, quote, "That's our business," he snapped. And the next day he was fired. And how could there be any argument about this, you know? It was dereliction of duty. So that game, as you can see here, this picture of Mark Murphy in the locker room, the great strong safety, what a great guy. There's Mark. And it was a crushing defeat. The wind chill here was minus 28 at kickoff, 3 degrees. And it was a tough one, Mike. It was a game that a lot of people remember, still remember to this day. All right, now let's move ahead 24 years, right, Mike, to December 23, 2007. Green Bay's already clinched a playoff berth. I think they're going for some home field stuff. They're a 9-point favorite. Packers are 12-3, I believe. I think that's right. And the Bears were like 6-9, maybe something like that. It was Kyle Orton against Brett Favre. The Bears were minus 8 injured starters for this finale. So the temperature was 16. And let's check the wind chill, Mike. The Bears were 6-9. At 11:30, 30 minutes before kickoff, the temp was 16. Winds were blowing between 22 and 40, and the wind chill was calculated at minus 18. No snow during the game. There were some snow squalls, but no accumulation. Favre called it the worst weather conditions of his then 276-game career. There were about 7,000 no-shows. Green Bay fans numbered about 20%. Well, the wind was the factor, Mike. Here's John Ryan, the Seattle. Two punts were blocked. Rob Davis, the long snapper, had 2 or 3 horrendous snaps. Nobody could handle the wind. I mean, the Bears did certainly a better job with it. Favre just, he was totally out of it. I remember talking to him in the corner of the locker room after this game. Favre endures the deep freeze in Chicago, the headline goes. He said, "It was cold as hell. I'm not going to lie to you. In my 16 years I've spent in Green Bay, I've learned that wind means everything. The wind cut right through you." Now, about a month later, they had experienced very similar conditions against the New York Giants, and they lost that game too. So, I mean, the cold really got Brett Favre late that season. Soldier Field can be nasty, right on the shores of Lake Michigan. You were there last year, Mike. What was the weather like? Do you remember for the first time?
It was the opener. So it was warm,
yeah,
as I recall.
Oh yeah, looking out over the yachts and things.
Yeah.
It was
a
remember
warm
that
weekend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
I don't think that's going to be the case this time.
It can get rugged down there, and there's going to be wind. It's going to be kind of icy. The fuel is not very good anyway. It's going to be a mess, and games like this can go either way. There's just going to be crazy bounces of the ball, and all the coaching and all the discipline sometimes kind of goes out the window. Some of this is just going to be chance. And, you know, we had the snow cleared off before the Seattle Packers took the field, and that really wasn't a factor. The week before against Houston, there's a couple 3 inches at the end, but, whatever. This could really be a factor. So it's going to be maybe an all-timer, huh?
Who knows? Did you ever play quarterback in a game with a ton of wind?
No, driving rain, but never really wind. No practice. Yes, I remember that, but not in a game.
Okay,
how can you kick and throw and long snap and?
I don't know.
Would you go out with no sleeves, Mike, Sunday?
Absolutely not. I think those guys are nuts.
Mike?
I got no skin on the bones here, Bob. I'm a lean, mean...
fighting machine.
I don't know what weight class I'm in, but it's about one-fifth of what, you know, these offensive linemen are in.
Mike, there's some historical stuff going on in this one. The Bears the Bears lead this series 94-93-6. The last time it was tied was October of 1933.
Your first year on the beat.
Art Daly would have, well, probably John Walter, Tony Walter's dad, probably covered that game along with Ray Pagel of the Green Bay Press Gazette. Who was covering it? Oh, I used to know those guys for the Sentinel and the Journal. Before Chuck Johnson and Bud Lee and before Lloyd Larson. Oh, I'm embarrassed. I used to know those guys. I didn't know them personally, but I used to know who covered the team back then for the Milwaukee Papers. I can't come up with it. All right, Mike. The Packers, however, have a one-point lead, 3,305 to 3,304. This is counting the two playoff games, Mike. Okay. Green Bay is 19-4 in Illinois in the last 23. McCarthy's 15-7 overall, 11-2 in his last 13. Green Bay's won 6 in a row in Chicago.
I got a question.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if you'll be able to answer it, but in how many different stadiums have you covered Bears-Packers? Lambeau Field.
What's Memorial Stadium in Champaign?
Okay. Lambeau Field, Soldier Field.
The two Soldiers, old and new.
Yeah.
Never Wrigley.
Okay.
And that's it.
No. Milwaukee?
Yeah, an exhibition game.
So four different stadiums. Four or five. Wow.
Forrest Gregg and Ditka exhibition game. The benches were on the same side. And Forrest and Ditka got into some verbal scuffles down there. And they never played an exhibition game again between the two teams. And Bob Harlan and Mark Murphy Judge Perrins have never scheduled a regular season game, I don't believe, between the two in Milwaukee. I don't think that ever occurred, but I'm not sure. The Bears have pulled two memorable upsets in the last 4 years, Mike. The Bears are a 6.5-point dog this week, right? Last year? Yeah, they were a 9-point dog, and they won behind Jay Cutler at Lambeau 17-13 in November. And in 2013, when Aaron Rodgers suffered the broken collarbone at the end of the first series, the Bears went on as a 10.5-point dog to win behind Josh McCown, 27-20, I believe. All right, so that's the historical precedent there.
So what's going on with the current Bears?
The Bears are 3-10. They're a wounded team. They got... if Eddie Goldman doesn't play the nose, that would put him down 7 injured starters and 1 suspended starter, Jarrell Freeman. So they're a hurting ball club. Are they a threat? Well, they're more of a threat in horrible weather than normally. But when they went to pristine Ford Field last Sunday, they lost by 3 points against a good team. So I think they're a little bit better than the team that was up here 7 weeks ago. Here's some of the changes in the personnel. All right, you got Josh Sitton back at left guard, replacing Eric Kush. Zach Miller, a real good tight end, is out, but yet Daniel Brown, a second-year free agent from James Madison, he's playing pretty well. Brian Hoyer, out, broken arm. Hit by Peppers and Matthews. Jay Cutler out with, I don't even know, what do you have? Hand or, I can't even remember these injuries. There's so many.
Cutler, I think it was a thumb.
Really?
I think so.
Okay.
Or an index finger, one of those two.
Okay. So you got Matt Barkley, who played the second half against Green Bay. I thought he was okay. But, you know, he's looked pretty good the last three games, his three starts. He could be 3-0, actually. If the wide receiver Joshua Bellamy could catch the ball, that cost him against Tennessee and Detroit. So on defense, there are changes. Both inside backers are gone since the Green Bay game. You got Nick Kwiatkowski and John Timmu. Kwiatkowski's got a future. Timmu doesn't. But, so they're weak at inside backer, and the Packers can do some things there. You got Pernell McPhee now, who's healthy, and he's a lot better player than Sam Achu, who played there against Green Bay. And in the secondary, safety is still no better than it was. Deion Bush will play, and he did not play against Green Bay the first time. But in the secondary, you've got Bryce Callahan, a feisty little slot guy who I really like him. And he lasted 16 plays against Green Bay, went out with a hamstring. They were decimated by that. They had to play Bosby and Jacoby Glenn, and that's when Devontae Adams had 13 catches.
A lot.
Yeah. So what do they really have going for them? Pass rush, just like Seattle, we thought, did, right? So you got three good rushers. You got Leonard Floyd, the rookie from Georgia, who's really come on, Mike. You've seen the snippets here and there.
I think he's a really good player, or has the potential to be a really good player.
He's not dropping anymore. They're just using him as a forward player. He doesn't know anything about coverage, and that set him back early. But now he's just playing forward. They're running a lot of really good stunts and games. One of those resulted in Don Barkley giving up a sack up here. Floyd, the ninth pick, he's really their future. Willie Young has kind of hit a bit of a lull here recently. He'll be up against Bulaga, and Bulaga pretty much owned him in the first game. And then you got Pernell McPhee, whose knee, according to one scout, his opinion is that McPhee's knee is not quite back. But boy, does that guy hustle and chase. He's a power player, ripped upper body. Pretty tough guy. I don't know that he can win out the corner. Now, they're going up against David Bakhtiari and Brian Bulaga. And these people have a way of just winning matchups, dominating matchups. And the field's going to be terrible to rush the passer. The advantage is going to go to the offense. And if they can do that again, the Packers could win this game handily. There's a really good D lineman for the Bears, Akeem Hicks. He's like 315. He's got movement. You see a spin move. The guy's got a lot going for him. He's really, I think he's having, Mike, maybe a Pro Bowl year. Splitting double teams. He's really a good player. He's got the most pressures. This guy is a bull rusher, and he's got some quickness. The inside's going to really have to be concerned about Akeem Hicks. Their safeties are a mess. You get time, you can pick that thing apart, and the inside linebackers are shaky. So, you know, offensively, you got Barkley. This will be the fourth start of his career. He's been with three teams. Is he better than Brian Hoyer? One scout said yes, one scout said no. That's what he is, right? Can he make plays? All right, they got Alshon Jeffrey coming back. Jeffrey didn't do anything in the first game. He's off a four-game suspension. One scout made an interesting point. Jeffrey had a lot of weight problems at Georgia. What's he been doing the last month? Nobody really knows, you know. He's in a contract year. He's going to be out there playing in horrible weather. Is he really going to want to play? Is he in shape to play? Does he have any timing with a brand-new quarterback who he's never really played with? But, you know, Cameron Meredith, I like the guy. He's a pretty good player, Mike. Illinois State, I believe it was, a free agent, second year. This guy can make some acrobatic catches. Now, I know Bellamy takes, and deservedly so, has really been ripped. But you look in that Detroit game, he made two acrobatic catches. I can see why they're playing him. He does have a lot of talent. And he's a guy, he has talent. He can make plays. He could beat somebody. Okay, we discussed the tight end. The tight end's a receiver now, this Daniel Brown. He's not Zach Miller, but he's really not bad. The strength of their team, it's the run game on offense. This is Jordan Howard. Now, he was only 7 carries for 22 the first outing. I don't know. Kadeem Carey had 26 snaps. Howard had 22. I can't remember if Howard was hurt. Do you remember anything like that? That was strange.
I don't remember.
I mean, the game was out of control, and they played Carey late. Maybe that was it, but... Okay, the last 6 games, he's averaged 20 carries and 101 yards, I think. That's a lot of yards.
Yes, it is.
He's 230. I remember what he did to Michigan last November of 2015. He had more rushing yards in that game, than anybody against Michigan. I don't even know if it was ever or 50 years or some crazy number. He killed them. So this guy's a player. He doesn't have great vision. One scout pointed that out. But he's 230, he's got forward body lean, And on a field like this, in a nasty condition, could he control the tempo of a game? Maybe. If the Packers are soft, maybe. It's hard to say. All right, Sitton, you know he's going to be motivated to play. Sitton and Leno are a pretty good left side, and Cody Whitehair is a really good rookie center. So they're good there. Ted Larson, he replaces Kyle Long. Now, if they had Kyle Long still, if he wasn't on IR, they'd really have something going. Larson's just a guy. The Packers have done business against him when he was with Arizona. And Bobby Massey, the right tackle, he's not very good either. He's a better run blocker, but there can be all kinds of pressure off his side. They have one good run-blocking tight end, Logan Paulson. Their kicker's shaky. Their punter's shaky. Their return game, Eddie Royal, I assume, is not going to play. He never plays with his toe. They got nobody to field a punt, Mike, and the game could turn in this. They're going to try probably with LeBlanc back there. I think he's been doing it. He's had all kinds of bad decisions. The Bears could be undone by punt return. I mean, if the Packers can get the ball off on this wind, they certainly can't return a punt, and whether they can catch the ball and secure it remains to be seen. So they're 3-10. They're 6.5-point dogs. Green Bay should win this game. It's a tricky one with this weather.
You mentioned when you were talking about Alshon Jeffrey whether or not he would want to play in this type of a game, given the conditions and everything. And that made me wonder, you know, because the Packers have made the playoffs for so many years in a row and so many of the last, you know, 15 years or whatever the case may be, you've seen a lot of games late in the year where they play teams that probably have nothing left to play for. Do you buy into the fact that teams who have nothing to play for enjoy the possibility of ruining another team's seed or knocking them out of the playoffs? Because that was one thing brought up today in the locker room by Jordy Nelson, is with the Packers being very much on the playoff fence, you know, the Bears could have a big say in whether or not the Packers make the playoffs. And Jordy said they're going to want to try and knock us out with everything they have. Do you buy that?
Well, let me say this, Mike. If it was a warm weather team coming up to Chicago or Green Bay this weekend, they'd have no chance. I've seen a warm weather team with a bad record. They just don't want to play. The Bears are 4-19 in their state against the Packers in the last 23. If they have any pride at all, you would think they would make a superhuman effort to crush this franchise up north that has lorded it over them. They know that the unbelievable fan support Green Bay has in Chicago and Illinois. It's all over the place. You see, I think at any time of the year, you see Packer garb on the streets of Chicago. It's just the way it is, and I'm sure it really rubs them the wrong way. Can John Fox get that out of them, out of a 3-10 team? With all these eight people out, eight starters gone, missing. You would think so, and they're used to the weather. But yet I've seen the Bears fold like a house of cards down in Chicago time after time after time. Green Bay has just gone in there and kicked butt, Mike, year after year.
Is Fox a lame duck?
Maybe. I don't know. The McCaskey family, they're already paying, you know, a coach. And do they want to pay another coach and hire another one? I mean, that remains to be seen.
Okay.
John Fox has won. He's won 136 games in his career. He's 136 and 116. He knows what it's all about. He's been in two Super Bowls. He may look like kind of a guy over there who doesn't really have a clue, but I think he really does. I've dealt with him. He's a hell of a guy, and he'd like nothing better, I think, than to win this game.
Anything else about the Bears we need to discuss?
We talked about the series history. Let's mention the starters who are out. Okay. You got wide receiver White, tight end Zach Miller, guard Kyle Long, quarterback Cutler. On defense, you have probably Eddie Goldman. I don't think he plays with that ankle. You got Jarrell Freeman and Danny Trevathan, the inside backers, and I'm calling Kyle Fuller a starter as well.
They're two big free agent signings, Trevathan and
right.
Freeman.
Freeman's been really – that's a huge loss. He played extremely well. Trevathan has kind of been hurt all year, not so much. So they're down to maybe you might call Barkley their fourth QB. Fourth, because I think Connor Shaw was going to make the team as a three. Barkley was, you know, in Arizona this summer. So You could throw in Hieronymus Grassou, the starting center. He blew out whatever he blew out in August. But I'm just going to – Whitehair, I think, would have beat him out anyway. Let's just say one starter missing in the O-line. So they don't have much, but do they have – the Packers have their injuries too. Let's face it. I mean, we don't know if Nick Perry's playing. Do you think he will, Mike?
McCarthy said he won't practice until Saturday. My gut says no.
Yep, okay. So the Packers have their problems. We have to see how Aaron Rodgers' leg responds. Legs respond to this this environment. It's kind of an interesting game.
Yes, it is. Should we take some questions?
Sure.
We didn't do it last week, so we'll take a look at them now. Okay, so we've got a lot of questions this week. Sorry we didn't get to them last week, but you sent in some good ones, so we'll take a couple now. And I appreciate everybody that wished me well in regard to the surgery. As I mentioned earlier, I got bumped to Tuesday, but it's nice of you that many of you remembered. I appreciate that. Okay. This question comes from Rich Rite. He wants to know, will the Packers transition Ty Montgomery to running back role exclusively next year? Well, Mike McCarthy said on Monday that Montgomery is now a running back. They would change his number if they were allowed to, but NFL rules say that you can't change numbers during the season, so he sticks with 88. But McCarthy said that Montgomery hasn't been to a wide receiver meeting in months, so he is a full-time running back, and I expect that's the position he's going to have throughout the rest of his time here with the Packers. Let's see, what else do we have here? This question comes from my favorite Packer. Wants to know, how much of the offensive line's success this season in pass blocking is due to teams sitting back in coverage and mush rushing to keep Aaron Rodgers in the pocket?
Some. These guys know how fortunate they are to be pass blocking for somebody who has that kind of mobility and instincts and sixth sense for pressure. At the same time, Aaron Rodgers does hold the ball at times, and that results in some sacks. I don't have the exact count right in front of me, but this is a very good pass-blocking unit, helped by a pretty darn good quarterback in terms of pocket awareness.
Okay. We have another question here that wants to know, is Joe Witt Jr., the cornerback's coach, as good of a coach as I think he is? Well, it's hard for us to know because we're not in the meetings every day and we're not on the field. And first of all, I wouldn't be qualified to evaluate somebody's coaching abilities anyway unless I'm there every single day and I observe other people as well. But what I think is unique about Joe Witt is the way he approaches his job, and I think it's different. You know, he was a guy that was a recruiting coordinator at Louisville, and so when you're a recruiting coordinator, you really have to find a way to essentially be a salesman to all these high school recruits about why they should come and play for you. And it's really, recruiting is about effort more than it is anything. The guy who puts in the most effort, the guy who comes up with the most creative pitches, the guy who is relentless in talking to these prospects and always returns the messages, that's the guy that wins a lot of times, from what I found in my time covering college sports. And Joe Witt carries a lot of those same philosophies over to coaching the players here. He makes motivational posters for each one of his guys at the beginning of the season and comes up with a different theme for each one about what he wants them to accomplish. He's a big believer in high fives and chest bumps and all these different shows of emotion during the course of a game because he thinks it translates over into positive energy that lingers a bit longer than a team would that doesn't show any emotion or interaction. What else does he do? He talks a lot to one of his closest friends who's a women's basketball coach at the University of Georgia, and they talk about different methods of motivation. And so he's picking up all these different techniques and things from the college level and translating it to the NFL. Now, does that make him a great coach, a bad coach? You know, I'm not qualified to say, but I think it's a unique approach that certainly resonates with some of the younger players.
I would add, Mike, you know, when he got here, he was really young. I don't know, how old is Joe now? Probably 38?
Sounds about right, maybe.
I have no idea. So then he had Al Harris, Charles Woodson, and those guys came to really respect him because he knew the game so much and he was straightforward, he was in their face. He doesn't make excuses. There's no quarter ass, man. I mean, he just, it's perform or else, and he doesn't play any favorites. And now he's got all these young guys, he's had a totally different cast of characters, And I see that he's improved their confidence. He doesn't make excuses in the face of all these all the injuries, the Shields injury and many others. He's pretty darn good position coach, and I think he's got an unlimited future, whether it's as a NFL coordinator, NFL head coach, college head coach. I mean, the guy's been here for a long time, and I think he's got a tremendous future.
I agree. I think he's pretty well liked by just about everybody in his room. Last question here. This comes from Tim Brever, or Brever, I apologize. How confident is Bob that West Ham will avoid relegation this year?
How many get relegated, Mike? I'm very worried.
You're worried about the Hammers.
Four get relegated?
Three.
Three out of how many? 20?
20. Three out of 20. And then out of 20 come up from the championship.
Okay, yeah. And the Hammers are sitting there around 4, 10, and 4, something like that?
Let's see. We'll pull up the table right now.
The table, huh, Mike?
Yes,
the table. The standings.
Not the standings.
The table.
So right now you've got 16 points, and that puts you 4 points clear of the relegation zone. That's not too bad. I mean, West Ham should be a top 10 side, but still.
So what's my record, Mike? 4?
4, 4, and 8.
Eight
losses.
Oh, 4-8-4.
Yeah, they do it the other way.
Is that what I said? I've been reading those standings.
They do it the other way, though. Ties go in the middle.
That something?
Yeah.
4-8-4.
So 4 wins, 8 losses, 4 ties. It's not been a great season for the Hammers.
No. When I picked them this year, Mike, I mean, they were coming off a good year.
Yes, they were. They had a really good season.
Fourth or something. The Hammers, I wore the sweatshirt, Mike, that you got me.
Yep.
And I wore the scarf for my walk a couple nights ago.
You support the Hammers.
The maroon and chartreuse?
Claret and gray.
Okay, the claret and gray.
Yes, I think that's it, right? Claret and blue, that's what it is, claret and blue.
At least it's not scarlet and gray, Mike.
Yeah, claret and blue.
At least it's not scarlet and gray.
You know, I almost brought up that 369 when you talked about Howard killing the killing the blue there. All right, we've gotten off topic. Sorry for that little tangent there at the end, but we appreciate all the questions. We've passed our expiration date here on this podcast. We thank you guys for listening, and we'll talk to them next week.
If we get back from Chicago.
And if I'm...
If you're
conscious.
Able. Yeah.
Talk to you guys soon. I want to love you.